Good evening. I don't think so.
No, I don't write that sloppy. I think that's a little note that Julie was working on.
Well, we have just a few questions this evening. I'll handle the most difficult one first. I almost said some smart aleck put this one in there, but maybe I shouldn't say that because someone might have legitimately asked this question. The question was, why? Now, we could launch into all kinds of philosophical rigmarole and gymnastics to answer the question of why. Why? There's only one answer to that question. Because. That's it. That is the answer to the question, why. Just before we began this evening, another question was given to me. And it's drawn from Matthew chapter 24. Want to take a look there. Take a look at Matthew chapter 24. I don't know this, but I'm assuming perhaps it was generated from one of the articles recently in the bulletin about the coming of the Lord. I don't know that, but I assume that. Maybe it's just from this person's reading and study. Matthew 24, verse 36 reads this way, "But of that day and that hour knoweth no one, not even the angels of heaven, neither the Son, but the Father only." The question is, does this mean that Jesus does not know when he's coming back? And only the Father knew. I believe that's exactly what that means. Now, whether Jesus knows it now, I don't know. I can only assume, being back in the bosom of his Father, sitting on the right hand of the Majesty on high, that he does know when that's going to be. Although, I don't know that. That's just my assumption. And just a real quick refresher on Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24 should never be separated from Matthew 25. They go hand in hand. It's called the Olive Discourse. They're on the Mount of Olives, just before his arrest and crucifixion. As you know, the Last Supper is in, what, chapter 26? I think he's arrested in 27 and crucified. Chapter 28 is the Great Commission and so on. So this is the last night of our Lord's physical life on the earth. And he's been, Matthew 24 starts really back in what we would call Matthew chapter 23. The things that he's about to teach are founded upon what we find in the last couple of verses of Matthew 23. That verse 37 of that chapter, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets, stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth, till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." That verse 38 is especially significant. The house of Israel being left unto them desolate. Pardon me. That is to say that God has done all that he's going to do with these people where his name was. Where was his name supposed to be? Where was it that he put his name? In that house. He was going to have that name there. I'm going to put my name in this city and in this house forever. And that forever has reference to till God says it's all finished. Forever doesn't always mean without an end. It means to the end of whatever God has decided. And this is one of those situations. And so when the Lord declared, "Your house has left you desolate," jump across to chapter 24, look at verse 15. I think this is a direct relationship to what Jesus said is coming. The house is desolate. "When therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand." Now, that would begin a study of the book of Daniel and all the prophecies dealing with this period of time and its timing, when it was going to be. We know this is in 70 AD. Long and the short of it is this. God was finished with that house, and he set in motion the final workings that was going to bring that house to its complete and total end at the hands of the Roman army in 70 AD. Speaking of the Russian army and the Chinese army and Great Britain and America, premillennialists see all those nations here in these chapters, in Ezekiel and Daniel and the Revelation and the book of Matthew 24 and Luke 13 and Mark 10. They all see these nations in here, thinking that this has something to do with the times we're living in now. They do not. So, finally, one final point. I'm not going to teach this chapter. One final point is that... two final points. Jesus is actually answering three questions. When shall these things be? There's a plurality of things. What shall be the sign of thy coming? And the coming has reference to his coming in judgment upon the city, to the desolate house. And then the third question is the end of the world. And that's what he deals with clear at the end of chapter 24 and into chapter 25. So that's what's taking place in this chapter, just as a quick reminder to you all. Once again, what does this mean from chapter 24, verse 36? I believe that when Jesus was on the earth, he had no idea. The Father had not told him when he was to be coming back. I believe that's precisely what that means. Now, whether he knows today or not, I can't answer that. All right. Here's a question that deals with expediency. I think it might fall into this category. However, for it to be expedient, it also has to be lawful. So it probably, possibly, most people would see this as an expedient. I'm not convinced that it is. You decide, and I'll tell you how I think about this question here right now. Question is it sinful in category if one goes to a tavern but is not involved in drinking alcohol? There's more to this question, but I want to deal with the first half of it here. I think there are a couple of... definitions that are in order first and foremost. One of those definitions is, the questioner asks, is it sinful in category? Or is it categorical? Do you know what that means? I'm assuming the questioner knows what that means. I think this person has probably worded this very carefully, very precisely. For those who may not be real familiar with that, what that means, now you know generally a category is like a column where you can choose from this category, you can choose from that category or grouping of something or other. Well, with reference to something being right or wrong or this or that in any kind of a category means without exceptions or conditions. That's what that means. It means absolute, unqualified, and unconditional. Is it absolutely unqualified, unconditional, always sinful to go to a tavern but not be involved in drinking? This does not call for a yes or no answer. I won't give a yes or no answer because such things are not categorical. There are all sorts of situations and circumstances that may come into play here, and I'll explain. The other definition that we've got to keep in our point of view here is the term tavern. What exactly is a tavern? Well, most people think, well, it's a bar. Well, you'd be right. That's exactly what it is. It actually comes from an old Anglo word from the 12th century, well, 1286, 13th century, that means simply a wine shop. A tavern is, by definition, a place where liquors are sold to be consumed on the premises. Now, that's an important point. It's to be consumed on the premises. It's not a package store. It's a place to go and drink. Okay? A bar, an establishment licensed to sell alcoholic beverages to be consumed on the premises. So, here's the first assumption that I'm making for all of us here tonight. And that assumption is that we would agree, I'm hoping this is true, that drinking alcohol is sinful. I hope that we'll agree with that, that it's never authorized by the scriptures. I hope I don't have to take time to prove that. Also, with reference to something that is categorical, what exceptions are there that allows drinking and to be in company with those who are drinking? What exceptions would cause it not to be sinful? By that, I simply mean maybe it is categorically wrong. Otherwise, what circumstances would it be okay to be in company with drunks? Now, by that, I don't mean people who are sloppy, falling down drunk. But if they're drinking, they're drunk. To whatever degree, they're drunk. That cannot be successfully denied. How does one qualify or set conditions where drinking is not sinful? I don't think you can. I think drinking is categorically wrong. There's no exceptions to that. Now, let me see. Let's keep this definition in mind, what a tavern is. It's a place to go and buy booze to consume it on the premises. So you drive up to the tavern. Let's just walk through this carefully. We drive up to the tavern, and we want to keep the definition of that in mind. Now, here's a question. Does anybody know what your car looks like when you're parking in front of that tavern or in that tavern's parking lot? Do they know what your car looks like? You walk up to the door. Have we committed sin yet? You open the door. Is that sinful? You walk inside. Would walking inside of this building be sinful? You sit down at the table with others who are drinking. Have you sinned yet? Maybe you drink a soft drink or a cup of coffee, or maybe you don't drink anything at all. Has sin been committed yet? In my judgment, my point of view, my opinion, there's no categorical sin in doing these things. There's nothing sinful about opening a door or walking into a building and sitting at a table. So where does the sin come in? Where does it suddenly become categorically wrong if it is wrong? I suggest to you it's a matter of degrees. Now, some people will reason it this way. I've heard this reasoning. Well, in fact, this closely related to this type of reasoning was expressed a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about, what were we talking about in Josh's class on Sunday morning? Something about this related thing about going to the store and buying groceries where wine is sold. Do you recall that? I don't remember exactly what point was being made, but here's how it's justified. I buy food from a store that sells liquor. Therefore, I can go and listen to music in a tavern. Right or wrong? I think it's wrong. I think they do not follow. And there's a couple of reasons why. And one is, I've got to have food to survive. I do not need music to survive. I have to go buy this food somewhere. I don't have to go to that kind of a place to hear music. I've got to buy food. I don't need music. And get music somewhere else where sin is not being committed. I believe that's pretty simple. Now let's look at what the Scriptures has to say about it. What do the Scriptures say? There's some principles that we must always keep in mind. Probably one of the first is Ephesians 5, verse 11. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even expose them. Now, somebody says, well, in fact, the questioner says, well, you know, my focus is on attending the music sessions that are taking place there. I'm assuming this means there's live music. And not drinking. Okay. But in light of Ephesians 5 and verse 11, are you participating with those who are there listening to the music also, but sin is also being committed? Yes, if you're not exposing it. Because Ephesians 5:11 also says, but rather, contrarywise, rather than go along with it, expose it for what it is. Shine the light on it. Now, is this person, this questioner, going there to expose the sinfulness of drinking? No. They've already expressed they're there just to hear the music. So that principle has fallen short. I think they're not being obedient to Ephesians 5:11. In Matthew chapter 17, verse 27, Jesus is talking to Peter about offending those who are in authority. Remember about paying taxes. Who should pay taxes? The strangers or the sons that belong to the household? Well, of course, the stranger does. So Jesus says, well, just so we don't offend them, go to the sea, throw in the hook, pull out this fish. You'll find money. Give that to the temple for the temple tax for you and me. Okay, remember that event? Jesus was concerned about causing people to stumble. So here's the principle of causing somebody to stumble, an important one that is repeated many times in the Scriptures. Matthew 18 and verse 6. If anyone would cause one of these little ones to stumble, oh, it'd be better if millstones tied around their neck. They'd cast in the depths of the sea. Better than they've never been born. Don't cause little ones to stumble. Some would say, well, the little ones there means those who are just novices in the faith. And some say, well, no, these are little children. I think it's little children. And he's saying, well, whatever you do, be careful of the example you set for the young. Because if you cause them to stumble, it's going to be hard on you. Jesus is concerned about causing people to stumble. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 13. Here's one we ought to read. I've just been referring to some. Now let's actually look at this one. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 13. The whole chapter of 1 Corinthians is dealing with things that are lawful or not lawful. Things that are expedient, things that are not expedient. He'll talk about expedience in chapter 6, and he'll talk about it in chapter 10. And in between, he tries to set down some principles. Look at verse 13 of chapter 8. Excuse me. Here he says, Wherefore, if meat causeth my brother to stumble, I will eat no flesh forevermore, that I cause not my brother to stumble. Here's my point. If even eating a hamburger, which is not sinful, might cause someone to stumble, then how much more drinking booze, or leaving the impression that I'm drinking booze, might cause someone to stumble, which is sinful. So there's some biblical principles here that we need to take very close attention to. Be careful the impression you're leaving with people and where you go and what you do and how you behave and how you act and so on. These are vitally important principles that far too many Christians overlook. Now, the second part of the question. Quote, I've been attending a music session that attends in a local tavern. My focus is attending the session and not the drinking of alcohol. Okay, so let's see if we can do this. Remember the definition. The tavern is a place to sell booze on the spot for consumption there. You drive up there. Somebody's going to see your car, see you going in there. You haven't committed sin yet, but what are they thinking? By your actions, maybe you have categorically broken the principle of what God is teaching. I believe you are. You were asking what the scriptures say about it. Here's my conclusion, what the scriptures are teaching about it. But I'm not drinking, this person might say. How many kids have said the same thing, high school kids have said the same thing about going to the prom? I want to go to the prom, but I'm not dancing. I just want to go and watch, listen to music, so on. Have some refreshments. Okay. Well, we've talked about that as well. Once again, we're still talking about the influence that you're having, the impression that you're leaving. Influence and impression. A couple of eyes. Let's make it poetic. That's an eye problem that some people have. Impression and the influence. And if we fail in these things, we've got an eye problem. And we need to go to the great physician and get it straightened out. What do people who don't know you think? There's something else you might want to consider. Is it important what other people think? In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, here's what the Bible says. Beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims in this earth. That's what he's talking about. It's who we are. This world is not our home. We're just passing through. You that are sojourners and pilgrims, to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. But I'm not drinking. I'm not dancing. I'm just watching. Abstain. What is it about that word abstain that's hard to understand? Abstain from fleshly lusts which war against your soul. Having, and here's the important point, having your behavior seemly among the Gentiles. Going to whatever the function is at a tavern, a place where booze is being sold for consumption on the site, is not good behavior. Can't be. Have your behavior seemly among the Gentiles. That simply means the unbelievers out here in the world. That wherein they speak against you. Well, who would speak against me because I go and listen to music at this tavern? Well, you know as well as I how people are. She calls herself a Christian. Well, I saw her at the bar the other day. He's a Christian. Well, I saw him going right into that bar the other day. That tavern down on whatever street. They speak against you as evildoers. They may by your good works, which they behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now watch this. Is going into the tavern, though you're not going to drink, to listen to music, is that a good work that people are going to look at and say, oh, praise God, brother so-and-so is going into the bar. Thank you, Jesus. You know how people are. Come on now. How can they praise that when that is not a good work? When they're watching what you're doing. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 22. Very simple. Abstain from every form or appearance, your Bible might say, of evil. What is the form of evil in view of this question? Drinking and drunkenness. That's the form or that's the appearance of it. How do you abstain from that? Simple. Don't go there. Doesn't mean don't go there and don't drink. It means don't go there. Don't have anything to do with that sort of thing. Stay away from it. Philippians 1 verse 27. My brother James was preaching this morning, and he was making reference to a couple of things, and I think he called this passage, Philippians 1, verse 27, and it clicked with me, and I thought, aha, that I think would go well with this lesson. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. Is the manner of life that is one trying to be worthy unto Christ carry us into into taverns, carry us into the dance hall, somewhere else where sin is being committed? I don't think you can say legitimately that that is an activity that is worthy of the gospel of Christ. You need to stay away from such things. Make a statement about those things. Matthew 5 and verse 16. Letting our light shine, let people see our good works. Is letting people see you go into a tavern equal to seeing your good works? Will they turn to glorify God by this action? No, they won't. Don't go where sin is being committed. You might lead somebody astray. And who knows, you might even be tempted to partake of what they're doing. You just might be. Long and the short. Here's the short answer. Is it categorically sinful? I believe the scriptures teach that it is. Even though it's not mentioned, thou shalt not go to a tavern to listen to music. I think in the category, with reference to exceptions of this kind of behavior, which is unseemly, is always wrong to participate. Question number two. Person says, this person writes, you must give back on the first day of the week. Is there anything wrong with giving my check to the server when he brings the cup? Short answer, no. What would be wrong with it? How could I say that that would be sinful or wrong? However, here's the long answer. However, there may be some problems with this practice. Now, there's another part to this question I'll get to in a moment. Let me just lay some groundwork. In Jesus' day, when he was on the earth, the contributions from those worshiping in the temple were given as the people were leaving the temple. There was a treasury, an area in the temple. There was a money box there. And Jesus was sitting over there in Mark chapter 12 and also Luke chapter 21, watching the people put their money in the box, remember? And the rich were giving out of the superfluity of their income. And there was the widow who gave just two mites. Remember? Sure, you remember that. If not, read it. And so, obviously, it was something that was pretty obvious. There was nothing blatant about it, nothing bodacious or braggadocio about it. That's just the custom that they had. That's how they did it. And I know of at least one congregation that does it that way today. When they are finished with their worship, the people rise up and start filing out, and they're dropping their contributions in a box or a basket or whatever that's at the back of the auditorium as they leave. There may be others who do that. There's no rule about how to give on the first day. How do we give in worship? Aside from those instructions given in 1 and 2 Corinthians. You know, dealing with attitude, dealing with amount, dealing with what day you give, and so on and so forth. What you're to do with it, that's to be laid aside, that into the treasury. Okay, so we remember those rules. There's no amount given. It doesn't say whether you should give it with your right hand or to your left, for that comes into this question here in a moment. Remember, though, somebody might be watching. If you're going to do this as a practice, somebody might be watching. Children, visitors who maybe don't know what's what. Is giving a part of the Lord's Supper? No. No, it's not. But some people have come to the conclusion that it might be. Because of our tradition, no doubt, some have come to the conclusion that if you don't have the Lord's contribution right, just smack dab after the Lord's Supper, you're in error. I know that's true because I counted it in Riga, Latvia. The church there had begun, and it was just starting to grow, and we had some visiting missionaries from the States to go over and work with those brethren in a campaign effort, and along came Sunday, and the Lord's Supper was given, and there was teaching, and there was preaching, and there was prayers, and there was singing, and so on, and the contribution was more towards the end of the assembly there in this place. And those American Christians they just got all unglued. This is horrible. Something's wrong here. Something's amiss. They just thought this was terrible. Why is that, brother? And this brother, a preacher, so-called, said, because they did not have the contribution at the time of the Lord's Supper like they're supposed to. And I simply asked him, show me where that says that in the book. I missed that. I've studied the Bible some years, and I think I missed that. And obviously, you know, don't you? He couldn't show me such a thing. All right. Giving at the time of the cup being passed. Here's what the rest of the questioner said. I feel like I'm being more quiet, and this person put that in quotes, or less eyes on me. That was in quotes also. And it's good for a person to have an attitude of quietness and be subdued. We don't want to be raucous and bawdy about things, especially in worship. This person says, "Be quiet, less eyes on me. If I give it when the cup, when I get the cup, instead of waiting for the plate, I am thinking of not boasting or letting the one hand know what the other is doing." I think I can understand that thinking, but here's some things to consider. This business of having less eyes on me, probably just the opposite is happening. That'd be my guess. Just the opposite is happening because everybody else has taken that tray and they've drunk that cup. And if they're sitting beside you or this person, whomever it is, they may not even be here. And they see you also take the cup and also give your contribution. Then they kind of think, oh, was this the time I should have given my contribution? What's going on here? So just the opposite might take place. Suddenly people might be wondering, what are you doing and why? Because you're doing something no one else is doing at that time. Does this draw attention to you? It might draw some attention to yourself. Maybe you're trying to avoid that, but I think it might be what you're actually doing. If attention is being drawn to you, then the exact opposite of not letting the left hand know what the right hand is doing is actually taking place. Now let's understand what that phrase means. Don't let the right hand know what your left hand know what the right hand is doing. Jesus taught that in Matthew chapter 6 when he's teaching his disciples about benevolent work. He's teaching them, listen, don't blow the trumpet when you're going to do something good for people. Don't announce it. Don't say, hey, look what I'm doing. Don't let the left hand know what the right hand's doing. Just take care of the things that you've decided and dedicated to the Lord. Just take care of that. God sees in secret. He'll reward you. He'll reward you for those things. So don't blow the trumpet when you're doing your benevolent works. If you were to take your... And so my point here being is this. How you, the attitude you have in giving your contribution really has nothing to do with that text of right and left hands knowing what the other one's doing. That's something Jesus wasn't talking about worship there. He wasn't talking about your contribution. Now, it might apply if you did this. Here you come to worship and you've drunk the cup. And at the same time, you're going to give your contribution. This is my contribution. You're going to give your contribution to the server. And you say, you know, and you're blowing a horn, blowing a trumpet, let people see, oh, well, they're giving their check already. Then that would be where the left and right hand teaching might come in. There's another thought, and that is this, and this might not be happening because I don't know the heart of the giver. But at the same time, it's always a dangerous practice to mix avenues of worship. That's why no one is singing right now while we're studying from the scriptures. No one is praying right now. Well, you might be praying, boy, I wish this was over pretty soon. But we're not being led in prayer. We're not singing. We're not giving. Various avenues of worship have their place. And that's the error that some fall into when they want to sing during the Lord's Supper. Or they want to sing during the contribution or something like that. You know, some modern folk like to do those kinds of things. There's no authority to mix those avenues of worship. So that might enter in as well. Again, I don't know the heart of the worshiper. I can only judge the fruits, and it's an action that might cause some questions, maybe a little bit misleading to some. And so hopefully that made some sense. Anything wrong with giving the check to the server? No, it's not wrong. But it might be misleading. Be cautious. Take care. Here's another question. This is coming, actually two or three questions, coming from the second grade class. All right, you second graders, listen up. Here comes the questions and here comes the answers. Were the ocean creatures destroyed in the flood? I've wondered that myself. I think the short answer is no. I don't think they were. I don't see how they could have been. Four times at the time of the flood, the warning of the flood, the building of the ark, and then during the time of the flood, four times the Lord used the phrase, the breath of life. And all the creatures that had the breath of life in them. Well, fish and other sea creatures don't have a breath of life. What about whales? Somebody says, well, okay, but they're sea creatures. They do have a breath of life, but they don't have to get out on land. They can live in the ocean. So I'm not convinced that that would really affect them. Note Genesis chapter 7. Here's the best way to answer that. What saith the scriptures? Genesis chapter 7 is where a couple of these times that this phrase is used, and it's pretty clear. It seems to me it's pretty clear. But this way, our young students will have the answer. In Genesis chapter 7, beginning at verse 21, pardon me, through verse 23, the Bible says, "And all flesh died that moved upon the earth." Well, that's not the ocean, is it? Both birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. That's not fish. And every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. Well, that's pretty clear. Only those on the dry land died, not those in the ocean. Every living thing was destroyed that was upon the face of the ground. Both man and cattle, creeping things, the birds of the heavens, and they were destroyed from the earth. And Noah only was left, and they that were with him in the ark. So how would flood water destroy something that lived in the water? Don't think it did. That's the long answer. Were the sea creatures destroyed? No, they weren't. They survived that. Question goes on to say, is earth referring to the land? Yes, I believe it is. That's why the water creatures are not mentioned and are not destroyed. I believe that's precisely why it's mentioned. All right. Next question, Genesis chapter 9 and verse 4. In Genesis 9 and verse 4, we are told not to eat the blood. Why? The simplest reason, simplest answer to this question, God said so. What more do we need? God said so. Now, he may have his reasons. However, he doesn't really spell out his reasons for it. There are some assumptions that might be based upon what we see blood used for. Did we not discuss this very thing this morning? You know, we did in Josh's class. I think Josh came to the exact correct conclusion on these matters. Everything he taught about this, I did not always agree with. But I think he's correct. I've changed my thinking on a couple of things, having listened to his reasoning. Oh, that's awful to have to admit. Nevertheless, I think he's correct on some of these matters about this eating of the blood and so on. God does not tell us why, except he says that the blood is the life of the flesh, or later he'll say life is in the blood. Now, what all does that mean? I don't know for sure what all that means. I do know that you can't have a transfusion of hydraulic fluid and survive. You can't have water in your veins. You got to have blood, and not just any kind of blood. You know, bird blood won't work. Has to be human blood. Has to be your type. Now, there is one part of the blood that you can take from any person, and that's the plasma. I think that's correct. Am I correct on that? But you can't have whole blood unless it matches you somehow or another. So, there's something about blood that keeps people alive. And, of course, science has learned some things about how it carries nutrients and oxygen and this and that and the other and all the things that I don't know and probably a bunch of things we don't know yet and science doesn't even know. Or God said so. Here's another thought. I wonder if perhaps it was one of the reasons might be because it was symbolic of the life that we're not to take. We're not to take life because life is in the blood. We're not to shed man's blood in particular. If we shed man's blood by man, our blood must be shed. And if an animal shed man's blood, that animal had to be put to death, had to be killed according to the law, according to what God said. Perhaps it's symbolic of the coming sacrifice for sins that will be seen both in animal blood under the law of Moses, Leviticus chapters 3 and 7, 17, chapter 19, Deuteronomy chapter 12 and 15. In all those chapters, here's the animal blood for a sacrifice for sin, and he said, don't eat that blood because it's given for a sacrifice for sins. And then also in the New Testament for Christ, Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission. So blood and the life that's in the blood may be symbolic of the Old Testament system under the law, animal sacrifices, and the perfect sacrifice under Jesus. Those might be reasons why God says don't eat the blood because of what it stands for in my point of view. That is God speaking in my eyes. That's what it stands for. So don't you eat that. Bottom line is this. It's a prohibition that's been given three times in the scriptures. Once before the law, under patriarchy, many times in the law, under the law of Moses, and at least twice under the new covenant of Christ, both of them found in Acts chapter 15. God prohibited it, and that should settle it. We're told not to eat the blood. Why? There's some reasons why, as best I can figure. Might not be good for you. Might be because of what it symbolizes. And simply, God said so. Let's do what God says, or not do what God says not to do. Are we still not supposed to eat the blood? The question goes on. According to Acts chapter 15, yes, we are not supposed to eat the blood. Is it bad for you? Physically? I don't know. I know that some people eat blood. I know they drink blood. They make, you know, foods from blood. And maybe if it's fully cooked or something, it's not really physically going to harm you. But that doesn't get around what God prohibited. He said, don't do it. And so, for myself, I'm not going to do it. Is it bad for you? Lots of living organisms can be found in blood. Seems pretty icky to me. I don't want to eat it or drink it myself. Yeah. Some blood is very diseased, and it would be bad for you. So, there's the answers to those questions, best as I can figure from what the scriptures tell me. And I hope they've been helpful and encouraging to you as well. That is all the questions that I have. We have a little bit of time left, so I'll give that back to you. I guess we have about 14 minutes. Of all things, and as is our custom, of course, and right in the sight of God, is to open the Lord's invitation to those who may need to answer it this evening. I believe everybody that I see here in this house tonight is a member of the church who's an accountable age. And therefore, let me just remind you all that if there's some need that you're burdened with, some prayer request, or some word of rejoicing and encouragement that you'd like to share with your brothers and sisters, this might be a good time to do that. If you need the prayers of the church, maybe need to confess some public error, then let us know how we can help you. I hope these answers to these questions have been helpful and informative. And if there are others, by all means, give them to me, put them in the box. We'll address them in the bulletin if you like. If there's something you might have just thought of during the session tonight, write it down. We'll put it in the bulletin. Otherwise, let's stand, sing a song of encouragement.